Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to Dev B315, Async Best Practices for C# and Visual Basic. My name is Kevin Filch-Bassan. I'm an engineering manager at Microsoft on the Managed Languages team. I've worked at Microsoft on that team for 12 years or so. The team that I manage directly is responsible for things like completion lists and refactoring and coloring for C# and VB. But I also am part of the language design committee, so talking about what language features we're going to add to the languages. And I've been responsible in the last few years as a member of the API design committee for our project Roslyn, the .NET compiler platform. Today, we're going to talk about async for C# and VB, kind of some of the lessons we've learned since we released async. It's been out there for a little while now. There's some gotchas. There's some things you can do to make your code perform better. There's some things you can do to simplify your code. And so we're just going to walk through some of those. How many of you guys are using async on a regular basis? So well over half. So that's great. So for people who aren't, this session is not going to be an intro to async. It's not about what it is or how it works. It's going to be kind of some specific techniques you can use to avoid problems with it and to make performance better, like I said. So what are the key takeaways that we're going to get from this session? So there's kind of five things that we're going to talk about. The first one is around async void methods, or async subs in Visual Basic. Right, those should only be for top-level event handlers. And we'll take a look at what happens when you don't follow that advice and some ways of dealing with it if you do. We're going to talk about the difference between CPU-bound code and IO-bound code and what you should do for different cases there to make sure you're not overstressing the thread pool or making your UI thread not responsive. We're going to talk about simplifying events and event-based callback programming using task completion source. We're going to talk about if you're a library author, how should you design your library APIs around async so that people can get the most out of them. And then on the performance front, we're going to talk about a little bit more about what libraries can do to reduce the overhead of async. So let's start off with async void. So the kind of scenario that we're dealing with here is that a user says, oh, this program works most of the time, but it doesn't always work. The specific example we have here is somebody came to us with a store app that did some projecting stuff. And they said, well, when I first pull up the report, if I click print too quickly, then it crashes. If I pull up the report and I wait long enough, then it works OK. So let's take a look at I don't have the actual code there because it was a little bit involved, but kind of a simulation of what that code looked like, what it was doing. So just to stress this point before we look at the code, don't use async void except for the places where you absolutely have to. So let's look at what that looks like. So this is basically what the code looked like. You've got a button click event, and it tries to send some data, and then it deals with the response. So you can see the two highlighted mget response things, and always a sign of great async or multi-threaded programming is the call to task.delay up there that says, well, let's just wait for 2 seconds and hope things are finished. So what actually happens to the control flow here? Well, we're going to start executing. We'll get to the send data call. And then we'll enter the send data call, and we'll continue through it until we get to the first await. At that point, await returns control to its caller. So we'll go back up here into the button click event after kicking off some work to get the request. And then what happens is you have basically two streams of execution going in parallel. This one returns, and so either of these two awaits can finish first. And you don't know which one it's going to be ahead of time. So what can we do about that? So the example here is if you remove the 2 second wait, then you almost always see a problem. You go into the send data method, you hit the first await, you return, and you continue. And the other thing that can go wrong now is you've already passed that exception block, that catch block, before the await for the web request has finished. And so the await machinery, it doesn't know what to do with your exception anymore. You look like, your code looks like it's okay, it's got a try-catch around the call, but there's nowhere for that exception to go because it happened after you'd already finished all of that code. So what happens instead? Well, it depends on what kind of app you're running. If you're running a WPF app or a Windows Forms app or a store app, then it basically posts the exception to the main app event handler, and then you can get an unhandled exception event that you can try to deal with. Or it can just tear down your app. So both of these are kind of problems with using async void. So some principles around async void. It's a fire and forget mechanism. It kicks off a task, and then it forgets about it. You have no way to know when it finishes. You have no way to know whether anything went wrong. So what can you do instead? Well, you should use async void only when you absolutely have to, only when it's an event handler, or something like an event handler, a virtual on something method that you get from because you're implementing some UI framework. Everywhere else that you use async, you should be using async task methods, not async void methods. And if you want to be fire and forget somewhere else, then put it explicitly in your code. Let readers of your code later know, hey, I deliberately started this task and I don't care about waiting for the results of it. Right? Just let them know that it's not a mistake that you did that. And then the last bullet on there is async lambdas. We're going to come back to that after we look at what we can do to fix this example code that we started with. So let's look at some changes that we could make to make this better. First of all, let's change it to an async method that returns a task. We'll change the name to follow the pattern of using sendDataAsync. And then we'll add an await up in the buttonClick method. And then we can remove the task.delay, because now we're actually waiting for the first thing to finish before we continue on, which means the async machinery knows if there's an exception. It means that we never get to print the m get response before we've actually gotten the response. All right, so this is a fairly simple transformation that we can do, just changing an async void method to a task returning method. So here's another case of event handlers, although in this case it's not actually an event handler, it's an event-like method. So this is a store app code. And when you navigate to a page in store app, you get to override this method that is a void returning method. But if you want to do something that's async, like, say, playing an intro sound, then what do? Well, you can make it an async void method, but and so there's another example of down here in load state. So this looks like we're following the guidance, right? I'm only using async void in places where I absolutely have to, where the framework says this is an event-like method, and so I don't really have any choice. But the problem in this case comes in because of this call to base.onNavigated2. If we pop into the code for the base class, onNavigated2 actually calls that load state method that we looked at before. So what does the control flow look like in this case? Again, we'll come in and we'll call base.onNavigated2. That will come in until it hits the first await, and then it'll return, and then we'll get to the await for playing the intro sound, and then that method will return. And once again, I have these two awaits that are both pending, and I have no way to know which one of them is going to come first. And so if the play intro sound finishes first, because maybe I'm on a slow disk machine or something like that, then the next line where I set the image source won't be loaded yet. And so you'll get this problem at the top where both pixel height says that it's 0. On the other hand, what you want to happen is you want to finish loading the picture before you set that thing. So what can we do here? I can't change the signature of these methods because they're methods that I have to override from my base class. Well, what I can do is I can use a task instead of using the bitmap directly. And so this, the body of the load state method, the part that's actually async, I can extract that into its own method that is an async task returning method, right? And in this case, it returns the bitmap image. And then instead of having an async void method fill in the actual state, the actual bitmap, I can give it the promise that there's going to be a bitmap sometime later. And then when my intro sound is finished playing, I can say, well, let's make sure that that task is finished now. So in this case, we're not firing and forgetting the task to load the bitmap anymore. Now we're firing it, but we're remembering it in this task field. And so we can wait for it to be finished later. So the next thing to talk about is lambdas. And there's kind of an interesting thing in lambdas in C#, because the type of a lambda is indicated by what you assign it to. And the problem with that is that the same body of the lambda, await, load async, result equals done, that can be either an action method or it can be a task method. And so if it's an action method, then you can run into all of these same problems that you've seen, that we just saw with async void methods. There's no way to know when that async lambda will finish. There's no way to know whether any exceptions are thrown in it after the first await. So if you look at this task.run method, which one will it pick? Will it be an async void lambda, or will it be an async task returning lambda? Well, we kind of got lucky in this one, in that if both overloads are offered, we pick the more specific one, which happens to be the task-based one. And so overload resolution will pick the right one if both overloads are offered. But there's cases that you can get into where that's not true. Before we get to those cases, to flip over to VB for a second, VB doesn't have exactly this same problem, because in VB, you explicitly state whether you want to have a void returning method by using async sub, or whether you want to have a task returning method by using async function. So you can see at the definition of the lambda which type you're getting, unlike C#, where it depends on its context. But the same thing, if both are offered in VB, make sure you use async function, not async sub. So here's another case of async void methods. This is something that you'll see pretty often in WPF type apps or store apps. People want to dispatch something, and so they use the dispatcher run async method. That looks great, right? They already know about async methods. I can just put in my async lambda, and we're good to go. Well, if you look at the code comments down at the bottom about what a dispatched handler actually is, it's a void returning delegate. And so even though this method says that it's async, that doesn't mean it waits until your whole async lambda is done. It only waits until the first await in your lambda. So let's take a look at how that flows, right? I come in to load async, and then I return, and then execution continues. And I get through my catch block, through my finally block, and I haven't actually completed that await yet. And so this debug print, chances are it prints that m result is nothing. Even though the dispatcher said that it was running it asynchronously, that just means it won't tell you when it's finished right now. It doesn't mean that it's going to wait for all of your async operations to finish. So going back to this slide about guidance, when you see an async lambda, you need to verify that you're using the right overload of the method that actually takes a task returning delegate to make sure that you can await for the whole results and to make sure that you can observe any exceptions that might get thrown during that. So that's kind of the overview of async void and the dangers of it. So I said there were 5 takeaways from this session. But if you could only take away one thing from this session, it's don't use async void except when you absolutely, absolutely, absolutely have to. There's actually, we spent a lot of time debating when we were doing the language design whether or not to even allow you to have async void methods. Some builds of the compiler didn't allow you to have async void methods. In the end, we realized we needed it because there are these event-based patterns, and you really need to have that fire and forget mechanism sometimes, but it is a place where we've seen people get into trouble. And so be very, very careful about async void methods. If you start to have, you know, this kind of non-deterministic behavior where it works sometimes, it works when the network is fast, or it only works when the network is slow, and those sorts of things, start looking for async void methods. Start looking for places where you're using lambdas that are turning into async void lambdas in delegates. So let's move on to the next area, which is about the thread pool, right? One of the things that is a very subtle point about async, because it allows kind of two streams of execution to happen at the same time, a lot of people believe that async programming is really parallel programming, and that it's using multiple threads, and that they're the same thing, and they're interchangeable. And there's really a pretty important difference between the two of them. And so let's talk about how to recognize what those differences are and how you can schedule things the appropriate way. So let's talk about another user problem that came in where somebody was saying, I have an ASP.NET website, and it does real estate type stuff. And so it loads a bunch of houses and shows me some information about those houses. And the problem is that it's pretty slow to populate this page. I want to show 20 pages or 20 houses per page. And deserializing those pages takes about 100 milliseconds, those houses takes about 100 milliseconds each. And so it adds up to quite a lot of time to render this page. I'd like to speed it up. So I think that what I should do is I should make it run in parallel. And so let's take a look at what that might happen, what might happen there. So here's an example of the initial code that just says, load the houses, right? For some count of houses for this page, deserialize each house, add it to a list, and then return them. It's pretty simple, straightforward code. And this is what it looks like, right? You start doing the work for the first house. When it's finished, you start doing the work for the second house. When it's finished, you do the third, and so on. And so if I have five houses and each of these take about 100 milliseconds, then it takes 500 milliseconds to go through this. So what happens if we do it in parallel? You know, the framework provides this handy built-in parallel.for method, and it says, oh, I can just change my for each loop into a parallel.for, and things should go faster. So what happens? Well, the request for parallel.for comes in, and it's got kind of a bucket of work. And what it does is it picks how many threads are on the thread pool, and it picks one unit of work for each of those threads. Generally, there's one thread in the thread pool for each core that you have on your machine. So, you know, if I'm running this on my laptop, I have a two-core laptop, I'm going to do two of these houses at a time. So, you know, that's better. I got my response time down to 300 milliseconds instead of 500 milliseconds. But there's some other interesting things going on. The question that comes in is, what is it really doing to deserialize this house for 100 milliseconds? In CPU times, the way that our CPUs are now, you can do an awful lot of work in 100 milliseconds. And so when we started to dig into this problem a little bit more, we started looking at what the work was actually doing. And it's actually downloading the data for each house from a web service. And so that initial serial picture that I showed you really looked more like this. I started some tiny amount of CPU work, and then I waited almost 100 milliseconds, 99 milliseconds or so, to download the first house. And then I do a tiny bit of processing after I download that data. And then I start the second one, and I wait 99 milliseconds for that one to come back in. And so that parallel.for thing, it still ends up looking like this, where I start a thread, I start a task, and then I immediately block on a network call. And I said that the thread pool generally has about one thread for each core on your machine. But one of the things the thread pool does is it tries to adjust how many threads it has to be as efficient as possible. And so it keeps track of, well, are each of those threads actually doing any work? And in this case, it might say, well, I have two threads. Neither of them are actually executing any work, and so the CPU is just sitting there idle. And I have more work to do in this bucket over here. So I'll add another thread. And so I'll start a third task. And then maybe I'll add another thread, and I'll start a fourth task. And then by the time, you know, we get to there, then maybe the first one is finished. And so we do the last task back on the first thread again, right? So my response time isn't the 300 milliseconds that I said before. It's maybe 200 milliseconds, which sounds even better, right? This is more performant, and so my pages are going to render faster. The problem is that the thread pool is an app-wide resource. It's shared amongst all of the requests in this ASP.NET scenario. All of the requests on that web server share the same thread pool. And threads are not free. This work created two new threads. Each of those takes up overhead to context switch to that thread and back from that thread. It takes up memory to store the stack for that thread. It takes up it's resources that you want to use responsibly. So what can we do instead of this? Ideally, what we would do is we would start all five tasks, let them all wait, and then whenever they're all finished, we'll continue. Right? We don't need more threads for this. We don't need two threads. We don't need four threads, because we're not actually doing anything with the computer's processor. We're just waiting. And so, what does that look like? Well, first of all, I change my method to be load async to indicate that it's actually not CPU-bound work. It's actually blocking the CPU, the thread, and waiting for some other resource to come back. And then I, instead of awaiting those directly, one at a time, I can just collect all of that work into a list of tasks, and then I can use the helper method taskWhenAll to say, oh, when all of those tasks finish, then I'll just continue. And so you can kind of generalize this if you want to have not five. So say we're loading 100 houses instead of five, right? You probably don't want to kick off 100 of those pieces of work at the same time, because maybe that would saturate your network bandwidth, right? So you can easily just put that work into a queue of work, and then you can decide how many of them you want to do at a time. There's a library that you can get on NuGet called the Dataflow library for the TPL that offers you some pretty fine-grained control over how to split up tasks and decide how many of them to run at a time. But you can also use this simple pattern where you just say, I have three methods, and each of them will work at the same time. They're all on the same thread, but they're awaiting results. And so in this case, I'll have three houses that I'm waiting for at a time, whereas in the previous example, we had five. So what are some principles for using the thread pool? The thing to recognize when you're dealing with the thread pool is that the difference between CPU work and IO-bound work. So things that are CPU work, those are things that are using your CPU, instruction after instruction after instruction, right? Things like linked to objects, or for loops over a bunch of things, or computations, right? Parallel.foreach and task.run, those are great ways to put CPU-bound work into the thread pool if you want to keep your app's UI responsive. And we talked about the thread pool will feel out how many threads it needs. One thing that's not clear to a lot of people is this last point down here. The use of threads will never increase the throughput of a system that's under heavy load. Right? You only have n cores in your machine. And if all of those n cores are already running as hard as they can, and they're doing CPU-bound work, adding more threads doesn't make that work go any faster. In fact, it makes it go slower, because now I have to schedule switching between the threads and putting one stack in and taking the other stack off. So the guidance here is for IO-bound work, things that block on the network or block on the disk or wait for some event to happen but don't actually need the CPU to be running, you should just use await for those. Don't put them on a background task. For CPU-bound work, that's when you want to consider putting stuff on a background thread. But even there, if you're writing a library, you should let the user of your library decide what the best thread is to run the code on. So if you have work, if you have a method that does a bunch of synchronous work, CPU-bound work, and you're providing a library, don't go under the covers and start using task.run to move that off the current thread, because that just means that the library controller loses, or the user of the library, they lose their control about where that code runs. And so you may think you're doing them a favor, but you might actually be hurting the scale if they happen to use it in a web type scenario where they actually just want to run the code directly on the same thread and not have any context switching. So, third section to talk about. My UI code looks like spaghetti, right? I don't know how many people have seen UI code that looks like spaghetti, but we can go back to that same first example that we had, and this customer came to us and said, well, you know, I have this event, this button click method, and inside there I need to subscribe to another event, and then when it happens I need to unsubscribe from that one and subscribe to a different one, and it's callback programming. We're not, again, that code was kind of involved, and so we're not going to go in and look at that one. But I have another example that I'm going to switch to over here on my PC, and we can take a little look at a little game and what we could do with this here. So, this is a little game that is a pretty simple game, and the idea is that it teaches kids how to count. And so they get a tree, they get some apples, and you put the apples into the shopping basket, because that's, you know, how you actually buy apples, is you go to the tree and you put them directly from the tree into your shopping basket. And so I can drag them in there, and there's not really any losing this game, right? I drag it, I put the apple wherever, and then eventually, if I put it close enough to the basket, it goes in the basket. And when there's no more apples in the tree, then the basket drives away, and I won, right? So the idea really here is just counting the number of apples. And we can play again, but no, we probably shouldn't play again. So let's take a look at what that looks like. So coming back over here, we have our mock-up of what this game is going to look like. And this is kind of what the code looked like. Right, so you can see, when you click on the event, when you click on the screen, then we look for where the thing is, and then we start dragging, and we play animations, and when the animations end, we play sounds, and when the sounds finish, we do more stuff. And so, you know, I'm falling off the right-hand side of my screen here, hooking up callbacks over and over and over again. And this is kind of what async networking program looked like before we added the async keyword to the language, right? You had to sign up to say, oh, when this download finishes, run this little bit of code and start downloading this other thing, right? So we've seen this kind of pattern of callbacks chaining together before, and we solved it once. So let's think about whether we can solve that again. So let's draw a state machine for what this might look like. So I start, and then, you know, there's animations that happen, and I go back into the same state, and then I can transfer to another state, and I press the button, and then I'm in the dragging state, and did it move or did it not move? Did I release it? Is it in the basket? And so this state machine is not actually simplifying my understanding of how this program works. And the problem here is events, right? You don't know when events are going to happen. And so if you have simple logic and events, that's OK. But when you need to coordinate the responses from multiple events, that's where this can get a little bit tricky. Events are probably not going to go away. They've been around for 50 years or so of programming and haven't seen them go away yet. So what can we do to kind of tame this? Well, let's look at the flow of this program a different way. Let's start from the events. So you can say there's basically three events that we deal with. We have a start event where we create the apples, and then we show an animation and play a sound. We have a resume event, and we have a pressed event. And the pressed event is a little bit more complicated. It says you drag until you release. You have to check if it's in the basket or not. And then you want to animate and play a sound at the same time if it happens to be the last apple, and so on. So this is a lot easier to understand than that state machine that we tried to draw a minute ago. And so I'd like to make my code represent this instead of representing the other thing. How can I do that? Well, it turns out that you can do that using async and await. And we'll take a look at how. So here's some sequential looking code that says, you know, when I press the pointer, then wait until I'm finished dragging. And when I'm finished dragging, tell me where the cursor is then. And then I can see whether it's in the basket or not. And if it's in the basket, then I can use that when all method. Again, I can say, well, play the storyboard for the animation and play the sound at the same time. When both of those are finished, then I see whether the game is won or not. And if the game is won, then we go to the victory screen. Right? So this is pretty simple code to read. But the problem is this, how do I await drag async? What does that look like? What does play async look like? Oh, well, OK, play async comes in the framework. So that one's a little bit easier. But what you can end up doing is you can write your own methods that are async methods that wrap around things that the framework didn't make async. And you do this using a task completion source. So task completion source is something that we added to the framework. It's how we implement most of the async methods in the framework itself. And so what a task completion source is it's a way that you can, it's a controller for a task. So you create a task completion source, you give somebody else its task, and then later, when you're ready to, you can say, OK, now that task is done. And their await finishes on that task. And so if we take a look at what this code looks like, we can look at the C# or the VB version. You can do it either way. I don't know which this room is more familiar with. But if we'll take a look at the C# one for now. So what happens in this code? So let's do one of those control flow things again. So we come in, we create a lambda. And what that lambda does is it uses the task completion source's try-set result method. That's the way you tell task completion source, hey, your task is finished. So what we're going to do is we're going to tell the storyboard, when the storyboard is completed, run my lambda. And what the lambda does, like I said, is it tells the task that we created that it's finished. And then we'll start the storyboard. And then we'll await that same task that we just created. And then finally, when we're done, we'll unhook our lambda so that we don't leak memory. And we'll return out of this method. And this is an async task method. So the compiler is going to generate another task for us to give back to our caller that they can then await. Right? So the task we create with task completion source, it's never going anywhere except this method. But all it does is let us put an await in the middle here, instead of having to hook up that event and then chain on more things and continue from there. So we can kind of flip the event handling inside out by using this pattern. So this is play async. I missed some of the animations for the walkthrough. So we returned out of the method. We came back in when the lambda was fit, or when the storyboard was completed, we run the lambda. That sets the task to be done. And so we continue executing, and our overall method is done. So it turns out you can do the same thing for a button click event, so that you can say, await when this button is clicked. Right? The pattern looks exactly the same, except in this case, I don't have to begin, because the system's always waiting for the thing to begin. Right? And so again, we come through, we run until the button gets clicked, and then we exit, and we wait, and sometime later, the message pump says somebody clicked, And we say, oh, well, we have a Lambda hooked up to happen in that button click event. So now go tell my task that I'm awaiting that I'm finished. And so we come back to this await point, and then we clean up after ourselves and exit the method again. So it's the same pattern, exactly the same as we had for the storyboards, we can use for the buttons. Like I said, this is how many of the async methods in the framework are actually implemented, exactly like this. Right? And so this is something that's kind of a little bit more advanced use of async, but it can be really used to simplify your code if you start thinking about things in the wrong way. So principles here. Callback-based programming is hard. It was hard when we were doing it for network I/O async. It was hard when we were doing it for everything else. It's still hard for events. And so you can think about trying to tame that by using this task completion source. If you really want to get into this pattern, there's a whole library called the reactive extensions that kind of flip events into streams of events that you can compose and await. And so, you know, if you want to go further with this concept, you can take a look at the reactive extensions as well. So the next major subject is a morality lesson. All of us have learned that lying is wrong. And so so if you're a library author, the same holds true. You should not lie. You should be a moral library author. And so what do we mean by that? Well, your method makes promises about how it behaves from its signature. And so let's look at an example. I have two methods here. One is foo, and another is foo async that returns a task. So just having a synchronous method, that tells the user of your method that this is a synchronous method. As a user of your method, I expect that it does whatever it's going to do right now, and that I'll get control again when it's finished. And there's also this expectation around the I/O bound versus CPU bound code that we were talking about before. I expect it's going to be using the CPU flat out the whole time it's running. Right? It said it could do work synchronously. I expect it to be doing its work. Right? It's not waiting for somebody else to do work. It's doing its work. Foo async, on the other hand, is kind of the opposite. Right? So its signature is asynchronous. I expect it to start some work and return almost immediately. I expect it probably doesn't actually take very much CPU time. And I could even kick off two of them in parallel, which probably means on the same thread. I'm just going to await them because they're not actually using the thread to do anything. Right? So these two methods that look very similar to each other, they imply a whole lot about their behavior. And so you shouldn't lie in those implications when you're designing API methods. So let's look at a more concrete example. Let's talk about a method that pauses for 10 seconds and then prints hello. And we can implement that in two different ways. Right? So one way is a synchronous way. We can have a busy wait where we spin on the CPU and we check what time it is the whole time until 10 seconds or later, and then I print out hello. On the flip side, I can have an async method that uses a timer. And again, we're using that little task completion source thing to flip this into an awaitable thing. And say, well, timer, call me back 10 seconds from now, and then my task will be finished. Right? In fact, this pattern with timers is so handy and convenient that we built it into the framework, and we just call it task.delay. Right? But now that we've talked about task completion source, you can see how to implement task.delay yourself. Right? That's what it looks like. So this method is truly async. Right? It's not using the CPU at all. It does a tiny little bit of work when you first call it, and then it returns control, and nothing else is happening in the system. There's not another thread somewhere else that's doing a busy wait. The system has got its own timer already running, and it will just call us back when it's finished. Now, here's another asynchronous version of this method. I can use task.run to call my original synchronous method. Right? But if I do that, I'm a liar. Right? because the expectation of an async method is that it's not really doing significant work. And in this case, it is doing significant work. It's going to take one of the threads in the thread pool, and it's going to occupy it for 10 whole seconds. Right? And that's something that's visible to my application, to my system as a whole. On the flip side, I can do the reverse. Right? I can take my nice true async method, and I can turn it into a synchronous method with a t.wait, because maybe I'm in a library where I'm not allowed to have an async signature, but I have some underlying method that's async. This one is not just kind of a yellow warning sign. This is a red sign. This looks like it's a blocking call. It looks like it's synchronous, but it's not. Why is this a red one? This is actually a great way to introduce deadlocks into your program, and we'll take a look at why that can be in a second. So there's some guidance here. You know, the Parallel team, they have some blog posts about this. They say, you know, should I expose async wrappers around synchronous methods? No. The framework already has task.run. Right? You should not lie about what your code is doing. The user of your code can look at the signature. They can say, oh, this is a synchronous method. It's going to spend a lot of time using my CPU. So I'm a UI app that's running on a user's machine. I will use task.run to move that to the thread pool myself. Or somebody else who's writing a web server can say, that's great. I want to use this thread because I don't want to take the overhead of spinning up another thread on my web server and reducing my load in that case. Right? So again, you let the caller decide where they want to run this method. And what you do is provide them the best information to make that decision by making your signatures look the way they really are. So on the other side, the how do I expose synchronous wrappers? If you really, 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 really have to, then there's some techniques that you can look at, spinning up your own nested message pumps that are going to handle messages and look at stuff. But you really don't want to do this. And we'll take a look at that again in a little bit. So we have the two cases here, the orange case and the red case. So I already talked about a lot of this stuff. But the dangers of using task.run to take something that is synchronous and make it look asynchronous is that, like I said, the thread pool is an app global resource. Right? And so you are making the decision for the user of your library that the thread pool is going to be busy. And then that can hurt scalability in server apps. And then the app is in the best position to manage its own threads. So let's look at the dangers of blocking that something that looks synchronous but isn't, that has the wait in it. So let's imagine I have a button click event, and I have a load method, and so I will just wait for that load method, and then I'll update my view. Well, what happens in there? On the left-hand side, there's a message pump, and so that's kind of what kicks off this process with the message click. So click happens, we come into load async. Load async starts the downloading of an async. We come back, and we start waiting. So now we're blocked, waiting. So what happens next? Well, the download finishes, and so we want to resume our async method. Well, how do async methods resume in UI applications? They resume by posting a message onto the message pump saying, I'm ready to continue now. But the problem is nothing's happening on the message pump because we're still in this button click handler waiting. We called in to wait, and so there's no way to get back around and look to see if there's another message in that message pump. And so your app just hung. It deadlocked. Right? You thought you were doing the right thing, but in fact you weren't. This can be a problem even if you're not on the UI thread. A personal example, as we were building the .NET compiler framework or Roslyn, we had an object that we called an async lazy, which is a way to kick off some work and construct it lazily. And we started using the IDE that was built on top of that, and people were running into problems where the IDE would stop responding. And so we started, and we were like, well, we're not actually waiting for tasks anywhere except this one little place where we're doing it on the thread pool. For exactly this reason, we had a signature that we wanted to look synchronous, and it was wrapping asynchronous work. And so we started looking at dumps of the processes, and there were 700 or 800 or 900 threads in the thread pool that were all waiting behind this one task, because that hill climbing algorithm in the thread pool says, oh, I hit a wait here. There's still more work to run. I'll start another thread. But the problem was, the work that it was waiting for was at the end of the thread pool. And so it had to wait until it got 700 threads up that were all waiting for that work before it could finally do that tiny little bit of work that it needed to do, and then everything could continue. And the only way that we ended up fixing this was doing exactly what this guidance is and flowing async all the way up and not lying about what that method was. The problem stemmed from the fact that we were lying and making a method look synchronous that was in fact asynchronous. So, said this again and again, right? The thread pool is an app global. Using it can hurt server scalability. You want to avoid putting things on the thread pool on your own. You want to let the user of your application do it. So, next thing is to talk a little bit about performance of using async. And I don't want to scare people, because the performance of async is really good. And so most of the time, you should never have to worry about it. You can just put async in your code, and you can put await in your code, and you don't have to worry about it. But if you are doing some heavy computation, and you're in a for loop that runs over 10 million iterations, and you want to have an await inside of that iteration, then it can cause some problems, right? And so, but there's ways to address those. So one of the simplest things to do is to expose a chunky async API. So this is a common term in network protocols and various other things, the idea of chunky versus chatty. And so the idea is that I want to await once and get a big chunk of data back instead of awaiting a bunch of little times and getting a little bit of data back each time. You can think of this in the networking world as I want to make one request so that I pay the latency overhead once and get all my data back instead of making 100 requests and paying that latency 100 times, right? So the same thing if you're designing a library API. If you can, make it into a chunky API. You can't always do that. So what are some strategies that we can do there? Well, first of all, let's look at what this overhead that we're talking about is. So here's a simple void method. People have probably seen methods like this many times. This is kind of what computing's bread and butter, right? We've been optimizing methods like this for 50 years. We know how to deal with these. We can pop in and look at what the IL looks like for that. It's pretty simple, three instructions, right? We're going to load a string, we're going to call a method, and we're going to return. So this is pretty simple. What happens if I add the async keyword to that method? So one simple change. We just added that bolded async keyword up there. Well, so let's look at the IL for this method. It's a little bigger. And if I scan through that IL, I don't actually see a call to console.writeline in that IL. And that's because there isn't one. All this code is code that the compiler generated to set up the async machinery for you. The real meat of the code is in that moveNext method right there. That is the state machine that the compiler generated. And if we look at that, it's a whole bunch more IL. And if I stare really hard, if I point it out for you, there you can find where that actual method was, right? So there's a lot of additional work that's going on when you use async. But how much work is this really, right? This is all pretty straightforward instructions. We're pretty good at optimizing them. The JIT does a pretty good job. So all of this extra overhead is about the same time as if you had a for loop with an empty body that ran about 200 times. Right? So in most of your apps, it's not a big deal, right? If you're writing an app that responds with users, that's on the order of nanoseconds, where your user operates on the order of milliseconds to seconds, right? If you're using an app that talks over the network, again, that's on the order of nanoseconds, and your app is operating on the order of milliseconds. So you probably don't mind that much. Unless you're writing a pretty intensive computational library, like, say, a compiler platform, right? So we care about some of these things a lot. As we went through the framework and we made bits of the framework more async, we cared about them a lot. But it turns out that this is not actually the problem. Those extra instructions aren't the problem. The problem is the state machine itself. The mental model that I want you to have is that the allocations are the expensive part. Actually, that's not true. The allocations aren't the expensive part. The allocations are really cheap. It's the collections of those allocations later that are the expensive part. An analogy is that it's really easy to allocate memory in .NET, but you have to pay for it later. Just like it's really easy to drink a little too much at an attendee party, but you have to pay for it later with a hangover the next day, right? So same thing here with garbage collections. Now, we did a bunch of work to optimize and avoid those allocations when we can. And so there's three allocations that happen for every async method in general, right? First, we allocate a state machine that holds all the local variables so that we can get them back later. Second, we allocate a delegate. That's the thing that's going to be in the task. And third, we have to allocate the task object itself, right? So here's a simple example of a method. But it's actually the case that the framework and the runtime already avoid the first two allocations automatically for you if you don't actually execute the await in that method. So in this little async method that we're looking at below, I only do one await every buffer length calls to this method. And so say my buffer length is, you know, a 4K page or something like that. So if I call this method 4,000 times, then I will hit that await path exactly once, which means only in that one call will those first two objects get allocated. Right? So you should think about adding a fast path through your asynchronous methods if there's something that's going to be called a lot, a way that to get back to your users without actually them having to hit an await in your code. So how does it do that? Well, the code that we generate for async basically looks like this. The first thing it does is it gets an awaiter and it says, hey, if you're already done, great. I'll just give the user back that data. Right? It's only if it's not done that we start allocating state machines and delegates and all of that stuff. All right, so what about the return task object? What can we do there? Well, turns out we optimize that some of the time for you automatically. If the task is what we called a common task, then we optimized it for you. The framework already has a task with a result of 0, and a task with a result of null, and a task with a result of true, and a task with a result of false, and a task with a result of null. And so if you happen to return null or true or false or 1 or 0 or any of those common values from an async method, then you get a singleton task that we already pre-allocated for you, and there's no additional allocation. But clearly, we can't know the result of every task that you're ever going to use. And so this is something that you can choose to optimize further if you want to. And so what does that look like? Well, let's keep going with this getNextInt async method. I don't have the slide that I thought I had. I'll switch back over to my laptop, and we can do a little bit of a little look at it there. So an example of something that looks like this is actually a memory stream. And so when we were implementing the memory stream async methods in the framework, we looked at this optimization a bunch. And so I have a simple app here with two implementations of memory stream. And it does some collection measuring stuff, right? And so I can run this app, and it copies a bunch of data into streams. And so we have one memory stream that does it kind of the naive way. And we can see we had 14 Gen 0 collections happen during this copying of a million bytes, I think it was. And in the second memory stream, we have only four. Right? And so what does this code look like? What is the difference between these two? Well, the first memory stream, we override the read async method to say read. Right? So we do the simplest thing that can happen. But the problem here is every time this gets called, the compiler generates a task. Right? Read, you can see, it returns an int, but this method returns a task of int. So where does that task come from? The compiler creates one for you. It does the allocation for you. So down here, we cache a task instead. So we just create one little task, and we cache it. And in our method, we check to see if we can use that same cache task already. Does it already have the right value? And if it does, then we just return it again, because it's already got the right value. And if not, we create a new one. So again, this is now no longer an async method. It doesn't use the await keyword anymore. Just like using task completion source to create a task, we're using task.fromResult to create a task. And so task.fromResult is the one that has that optimization about using the known values already for you. That's actually what the compiler inserts a call to. But you can use it for any result you want. You can just say, give me a task that's already finished, and its result is this value. And so that's what we do here. This is a very simple caching strategy, right? We have one task that we hold on to, and it has one value, and we reuse it if it's the same value as the one before. But you saw in my example there, just doing that had a 3.5 times improvement on the number of allocations that you had. Okay? So you can do this sort of thing yourself to take a look at where can I reuse an existing task. If I'm going to return the same value a bunch of times, then maybe I want to change my method to not have an await in it, and instead store the task that I'm going to return multiple times. So I'll flip back over here. And so principles for chunky versus chatty APIs are, just like we said the thread pool was an app global resource, the garbage collection is an app global resource. In .NET, most of the time when the garbage collector runs, it actually stops all the threads in your application, and it's a pretty invasive operation to go and clean up all of that garbage. This is kind of it's actually one of the most common performance issues in .NET apps is waiting for garbage collections. And so the more you can do to think about these things as a library author where you might be called in tight loops, the better. So what can we do? Well, first of all, we can design our APIs to be chunky where possible so that my caller only needs to use await to get a big block of data once. And then they can operate on that data very quickly afterwards, right? So then I only allocate once for that big chunk. If I can't do that, then I can look at optimizing the fast path so that I can avoid an await most of the time. And if I want to go even further than that, I can look at caching the tasks that I want to return. All right, we have a few minutes left, so let's look at one kind of bonus thing that you can do as a library author. And that's consider using the configure await method on places where you have tasks. And so this is a kind of tricky concept that a lot of people don't understand. So let's take a look at what configure await is and what happens here. For a long time, I think we added it in .NET 3.5, we've had something called a synchronization context. And there's kind of a synchronization context that's a global thing that's sitting around. And it's a target for work. And so the idea is that apps that want to do work, they can find a synchronization context, they can find the current synchronization context, and they can say, hey, synchronization context, do some work for me. And so there's one that if you're in a Windows Forms app, then you would get one where its post method does a begin invoke. right? And you, there's one if you're using a WPF app whose post does a dispatcher.begin invoke. And there's a default one whose post puts your work onto the thread pool. And there's an ASP.NET one whose posts just make sure that they happen one at a time, that they don't overlap, so that you don't end up with parallelism problems in your code. And so when we designed await, we wanted you to be able to use it from all of these contexts, and we wanted it to seem like sequential code in those contexts. And so the way that await continues work is it uses the synchronization context and says, hey, can you do this work for me? So that means if you're in a WinForms app, as I was saying, every await that you do ends up doing a control.begin invoke. Or if you're in a WPF app, everyone does a dispatcher.begin invoke. And so if you're a library, you probably don't care about being on the UI thread, because you shouldn't be changing UI objects from your library anyways. Sorry, this is... So it's rarely needed when you're in a library, right? Because you don't need to resume on the same thread you were before. You don't need to resume on the UI thread because you're not touching controls. You're providing data back to your caller. You don't care what thread you continue on. And so you can avoid this by using await some task dot configure await false, right? It suppresses this using of post and just says, run it wherever that work happened to finish. If I was doing I/O and the operating system gave me an I/O completion port on some random kernel thread and said, okay, the I/O is done, great. I can continue here. I can keep running here. If someone was doing work on the thread pool and that work finished on the thread pool, great. I can continue running on the thread pool. I don't have to wait to get back onto that UI thread. Now, some of you are probably saying, well, what if I awaited something? What if my app awaited something? Shouldn't it get back onto the UI thread? Well, it turns out that it doesn't actually matter, because they have their own await. And as long as the person writing the UI doesn't put configure await false, their await will capture their synchronization context. And so all of your work will happen on whatever thread it happens to work on. And then when all of it finishes and their await kicks in, it will go back to the UI thread. Right? And so this is this can provide some performance improvements if you're working on a library that does a lot of awaits. I know I'll plug the Roslyn compiler frame, or the .NET compiler framework, or Roslyn, that we've been working on. We actually built ourselves a custom diagnostic that looks for anywhere where we use await that doesn't have a configure await false. And it's an error in our build process if we ever check one of those in. Just because we're trying to make a high performance library there. And so this is one piece of guidance that's pretty easy to do that helps you get there. So consider configure await in libraries. Again, the message queue is an app global resource. And by default, await uses it. But you can choose not to, right? You can choose to just continue on whatever thread you happen to be running on. So a few other sessions. So that's actually all my content. I'm going to do questions in a second, but I wanted to get through this. Related sessions. Yesterday, I gave a talk about the .NET compiler platform, Roslyn, the future of C# and VB, language features, IDEs, those custom diagnostics. The recording is up now on Channel 9 if you're interested in watching that. Tomorrow afternoon, I'll be giving a talk about what are some C++ scenarios you might be interested in as a C# developer. And then another kind of overview session of .NET in general was given yesterday by Jay Schmelzer, and so that might also be interesting. And I'll be at table 44 at the Ask the Experts event tonight. Click through. So at this point, anybody who wants to stay and ask questions, happy to answer questions. I can get a few of them on the recording before we go. I also know that it's 10 minutes till lunchtime, so I'm not going to be too offended if you take off to go get at the front of the lunch line. Thanks, everybody.